Hello, it's Friday, 19th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson. On today's show, Gary Bowman and I will be rounding up the top eight statistical travel and tourism talking points from across the region. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So we've not done a top eight statistical talking points show since November 2023. So we are long overdue, particularly as 2024 is turning out to be a year of shouting loudly about numerical milestones in travel across the region. Over the next 30 minutes, Hannah and I will travel around ASEAN with stopovers in Singapore, Laos, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, Japan, and of course, because we are talking statistics, Thailand. So, Hannah, where should we start?
Well, let's start off always like we do with a kind of look at how the region is doing in general, and a bit of a throwback to 2023, because we hit a big milestone, didn't we, in ASEAN for once recently?
Yeah, so figures published last week, I think, by Nikkei Asia showed that ASEAN, the 10, well, actually 9 countries of ASEAN, because Brunei figures weren't available, surpassed 100 million visitors in 2023. Quite a milestone, I'd say, 100 million visitors. It's around about 70% of where it was in 2019. In 2019, there were 143.6 million visitors. So there's still a lot of catching up to do, whether that will happen this year or 2025, or you know, whether it'll actually happen ever. Let's wait and see. A lot of that shortfall, of course, was because the Chinese market, around about 11 million Chinese visitors to ASEAN last year, compared to almost 33 million in 2019. So you know, there's a gap there of about 21 million. But even if you account for that gap, the region is still about 20 million plus visitors on a shortfall in 2023 versus 2019. So there's catch up in the Chinese market and there's catch up in the general market, Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, I think it is no surprise who got the lion's share of the visitors. It was Thailand, right? So Thailand had about 28 million. As a reminder, Malaysia was about 20 million. So behind that, and then behind that was Singapore at 13 million. Vietnam at about 12.6 million, and then Indonesia 11.5. And then you've got countries like Cambodia and Philippines at about 5 million each, Laos 3.4. And like you say, we don't have Brunei yet, and Myanmar is pretty negligible as well, for obvious reasons. So, you know, it's following what you would expect. Thailand has always had the lion's share of the results. And if we look at where we are right now in 2024, and of course, you know, as we always say, different countries release their stats at different times. So Malaysia, we have no clue. Cambodia, we've got January and that's about it. Laos, no clue. But for the ones who have kind of declared and reported their Q1 results so far, Thailand, of course, has the lion's share again. We're talking about 9.4 million international visitors they've had so far. And in fact, I think they announced this week that they've just passed 10 million now. So they've crossed that milestone already. Looks like they're pretty confident about hitting, I think, around 38 million or so this year, which is very, very close to the 39.9 million that they had in 2019. So after Thailand, you've got Vietnam, which is 4.6 million and has just narrowly pipped Singapore, actually. Singapore is 4.4 million. So there's not much in it, but you know, Vietnam is significantly picking up. You know, they've overtaken Singapore now in terms of arrivals. And then you've got Philippines, their Q1 down at 1.6 million. And Indonesia, they've only got January to February numbers, but you know, they're ahead of Philippines already. They're almost 2 million. So it's kind of trundling along, tracking more or less, I think, against what countries are targeting. And there's still, no one is really still targeting a full recovery. I think the exception is Malaysia, which really thinks it's going to have, I think, about 27.3 million arrivals this year. But, you know, as we said before, I think a lot of this is largely driven by that cross-border, by the fact that the ringgit is doing particularly badly against the Singapore dollar. And so you're getting a lot of those day trippers in. Oh, there's those excursionists in from Singapore, which will drive those international arrivals up, but not necessarily, as we've always said, delivering that same amount of value as, say, a medium haul or a longer haul traveler might bring.
Yeah, that's a good summary. So I guess to summarize where we really are, Hannah, at the end of the first quarter of 2024, well, we're actually moving quite quickly into Q2, but 100 million or so in 2023 visitors. That's a pretty strong recovery, really, in the what was really the first full year of travel and tourism activity in Southeast Asia. As you said, most countries this year are tracking around about where they hope to be in terms of the full year. In some countries, we're going into a bit of a slower period at the moment. So let's see how that works out. Most countries are kind of projecting for slightly lower figures in the second quarter. But to boost this, Hannah, Thailand has had another idea up its sleeve, and that's the 6 ASEAN nations visa. There's been a lot of media coverage about this recently, comparing it sometimes to the Schengen visa in Europe, which, you know, that has its failings because it's very, very different to the Schengen visa. But there are some interesting comparisons as well. So the 6 countries, Hannah, that Thailand wants to create a travel visa, a border-free, really, region, are all in mainland Southeast Asia. So Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos. 4 countries that are missing would be Singapore, Philippines, Indonesia, and one other. What's the other one, Hannah?
Brunei.
And Brunei. What do you think about this? It's getting a lot of traction. Thailand is putting forward this as a proposal to boost travel across borders pretty much. I'm kind of confused. There isn't a great deal of clarity. Do you think this is aimed more at intra-regional travel amongst those nationalities? Or is this to try and boost travel from inbound travelers into the region?
I think it's inbound into the region because intra-ASEAN, generally ASEAN countries don't need a visa to enter one another's countries. So, I mean, unless you're talking about long haul travelers, then I think the ultimate aim is to get these long haul travelers into one ASEAN country and to lengthen their trip and to kind of collect ASEAN countries as they go and extend that. It's not going to work, is it? I hate to be the cynic and poor. You know, we saw, and I think I've said this before, I can't remember if I've said it on the podcast, but we saw how difficult it was when even during the pandemic, that most critical time to get tourism back, and there was talk of this intra-ASEAN tourism corridor, and it never, ever happened. And I just think now, at this point where everybody is a competitor to everybody else, it's not going to work. No one else is going to want it. Thailand might want it. Laos might want it, and Cambodia, because they're hoping that they're going to get that spillover from Thailand. Malaysia, they don't need it. They have visa free for so many different countries. It's not an issue, really, getting in here. Myanmar, really? Like, is there any value to go? No, you know, that's not going to work right now. Vietnam, maybe. They do have visa requirements for some countries, not all. So I just can't see it being a game changer. I can't see it being implemented. For me, it's a hard no. What's your opinion, Gary?
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I actually look back because I was confused by these comparisons with Schengen because it's nothing like Schengen. The Schengen visa was basically aimed at not just promoting travel, but promoting people to be able to live and work in different locations, different countries of Europe. It's not just about travel. This one is a pure travel visa. And actually, the Schengen visa was first proposed in 1985 by 5 countries, by 5 members of the European Union. It now actually has 29 different members, but it took 10 years for them to actually get it through. And it only became an act of law in 1999, so it took 14 years. And remember that Europe has a European Parliament, so it actually has the institutions to underpin not just the management and the overseeing of a cross-border visa, but you know, all of the other resources that go with it. This is basically 6 members of the 10-member ASEAN bloc going it alone. And as you say, they're all in competition with each other, and it doesn't make a great deal of sense. At the moment, there is some speculation about whether the actual visa would be extended from a 30-day visa to a 90-day visa, which I guess then would make a bit more sense. But No, the majority of trips, if you're even if you discount the long haul visitors into our into the countries of this region, are fairly short. You know, they're nowhere near 30 days, and I just don't really see that the take up would be that high, even if they could overcome what will be insurmountable political issues.
Yeah, and I don't really see how it could benefit Thailand. I know Thailand is the one proposing it, which is the puzzling one because probably they've got the most to lose from it in a way, because they're getting the lion's share of arrivals into the region anyway. I would totally understand it if it were a country like Cambodia or Laos suggesting this, because then they have a lot more to gain. But I don't get it unless they take a route like how some East Asian countries do it, don't they? And I'm trying to remember the details off the top of my head, but there are certain, who was it? We were talking to Pauline, weren't we? I think from Astindo, who was saying that for certain countries, if you have a visa, or let's say Japan, you can go to, I don't know, this is completely made up, but you know, if you have a visa for Japan, you can go into Taiwan visa free for certain countries. There are that's that kind of level of recognition. Maybe if they have something like that and say, oh, okay, right, you qualified for a visa for Vietnam, therefore I'll let you into the country too. Maybe they can do that, but it would really have to be on that kind of country by country basis, not on a blanket, you know, six countries out of ASEAN basis. It just feels very messy. I kind of want to grab headlines, but a bit like the tourism fee, but you know, how are you actually going to put that into action? I think it's a completely different question.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say watch this one disappear pretty quickly. So let's move on, Hannah, to number three. And this is a really interesting story because it's the other in Southeast Asia, obviously, that the major tourism success story really of the past couple of years has been Thailand. In Northeast Asia, it's been Japan. Japan's recovery in last year, in 2023, was astonishing, given that it only really opened at the end of 2022. And this year, it started the year absolutely flying. And in March, received a record 3.08 million visitors, the first time it's achieved more than 3 million visitors in a single month. I think the last record was something like 2.99, and that was back in 2019. But the interesting thing here, Hannah, I think, is the number of markets from Southeast Asia that are growing in terms of their visitation to Japan. It is a really hot destination, isn't it?
For sure, everybody wants to go to Japan, you know? So if you look at Singapore, if we compare March 2019 to March 2024, 2019, they had about what, 44,000? Last month, they had 61,000. It's huge. Same Philippines went from about 48,000 to almost 79,000. So there's just this huge jump in Southeast Asian interest in getting there. And of course, it isn't only from Southeast Asia. You see a lot of other a big jump from South Korea into Japan as well, for example. And I think what is more impressive about Japan's recovery is that it is not being really driven by the Chinese market. Yes, Chinese market has come back, but it is still not back at pre-pandemic levels. This is really being driven by other markets just getting into Japan. And I think, you know, a lot of it is to do with obviously the weakened yen. And I think this week it dropped to even further lows, I think, didn't it? Against the USD. So it's seen as a hot place to go. It's always been on the wish list. And now it's just got that little bit more affordable. And Southeast Asians are flocking there.
Yeah, and of course, March also was Sakura season. So, you know, it was another popular reason for going there. I think the interesting thing that you said there, Hannah, is that this recovery of the Japanese inbound market is happening despite China. If you go, I actually looked through the top 20 inbound markets to Japan from January to March this year. So, the first quarter of this year, only two of the markets actually recorded negative growth compared to the same period in 2019. One of those was Thailand, which was negative 7%, and the other was China, which was negative 38.8%. So you can look at that from two ways. You could say glass half full or glass half empty. You could say Chinese aren't traveling to Japan in the same numbers, or you could say the Chinese aren't traveling in the same numbers to Japan as yet. There is still a lot of that market to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that the I think the only way for Japan is up. but super interesting about Thailand, actually, that -7% down. And I just wonder, is outbound travel from Thailand slowing down a little bit? Certainly from what I've been hearing on the word on the street from agents is, I think consumers are feeling the crunch a little bit. I think that there is perhaps not been quite so much of the appetite to travel overseas. But then, you know, April, we'll see in April, right? When April is the Songkran, really peak season for Thai outbound travel. How do they do to Japan? And maybe we'll see a plus 30%, plus 40%.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually, because when you look across the region at the markets that grew, one of the smallest growth actually was from Malaysia as well. So there's a bit of a crunch here as well in terms of the value, as you said earlier, of the ringgit and also economic sentiment here. So let's watch those over the coming months. Hannah, let's move on to number four. This is a good story. This takes us to the Philippines. Tell us a little bit more.
So our stat is 1 a.m. So I've gone for a timing this one. And this is the time that Filipinos started to queue up for Emirates cabin crew recruitment in Manila. So it opened at 7 a.m. The screening was running from 7 to 11 a.m. And already from 1 a.m., Filipinos were queuing up. And this is the first time, actually, that Emirates were recruiting for cabin crew in the Philippines after a 14-year hiring freeze. So it's super interesting. You know, when I was reading around, it seems like Emirates is, you know, a preferred airline for the Philippines. It makes sense, the fact that there are a lot of overseas Filipino workers working in Dubai as well. So I guess they just see Dubai as just a very, very desirable place to work, a good place to work. But this, you know, for me, it always it's very interesting. And, you know, I'm looking a lot into human capital at the moment, so it's really on my brain. But the fact that so many people are wanting to go outside of the Philippines to look for those job opportunities rather than stay in the Philippine tourism industry. And I think that's the issue that Southeast Asia is facing a lot here, is that kind of brain drain from certain countries, workers being nabbed by other countries. So from that point of view, I think it's really interesting that there was such an excitement to go work for Emirates or try and get their opportunity to go work for Emirates.
Yeah, that's a great story. I got nothing I can add to that, Hannah. I think you've nailed that one pretty well. Let's move on to number five. And our statistic here is 2, quite a low number, but not when you actually look at the financial value. And 2 relates to Vietnam and the number of high-speed railways that it wants to build to connect the capital, Hanoi, with destinations in China. These both are scheduled to begin construction, I think, in 2030, so still a few years away. And they ultimately are part of what we've discussed before on the show, Hannah, that Vietnam wants to build a north-south high-speed railway connecting Hanoi with Ho Chi Minh and then all the cities along the East Coast. It's a massive, massive undertaking. It's been on the books for a long, long time. I was talking to James Clark about this a few weeks ago from Future Southeast Asia, and he said it's actually been promulgated for about 20 years. But the interesting thing now is that the wheels seem to be in motion because of that connectivity with China. That's going to be the crucial part of this, because the project is going to cost a gazillion billion dollars. It says $70 billion, but I would think that's just a starting point. These projects always go over budget and they take a long, long time. But building this high-speed railway will need financing. And you suspect that building this connectivity with China brings Chinese financing into play for what will be one of the biggest infrastructure projects in Southeast Asia, and probably one of the most successful, I'd imagine. Vietnam has a large population. A high-speed railway, if it were to happen along that coast from north to south, brings in most of the cities, the major cities of the country. There's a lot of opportunity there, but it's a long-term project. What do you think, Hannah? Do you think it will ever happen?
Well, they've been talking about the Long Tan Airport, haven't they, by Ho Chi Minh City for the longest time as well, and that's pretty slow to come off the ground. So it could happen by start construction by 2030, not too sure. But I love that gazillion billion dollars. Yeah, probably in Vietnamese dong anyway. I think what else is interesting is you just so, you know, you were talking about it as well with James. It's just so many countries are after that connectivity with China now. There was an article this week as well about Thailand, who were just signing off on this high-speed rail link to China. The interesting bit about where, because they're envisaging two linkages from Hanoi to China, so one to Yunnan province and one to Guangxi province. But along those lines, there's lots of areas for manufacturing around there, many which are Chinese owned. So you can really see that, you know, that this is not just for passenger trains, this is for freight as well. You know, I'm sure that there has that with that in mind as well, that connectivity to be able to move goods from one country to the other, which, you know, always provides a lot more of a incentive than purely the passenger play.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you do mention that every country in Southeast Asia is putting forward proposals for high-speed rail. I wrote in my newsletter a couple of weeks ago that a high-speed railway is the new Taylor Swift concert in Southeast Asia, because every government wants one. And it actually got picked up by media. I actually got journalists coming and asking me if they could use the quote. And I said, yeah, well, fine, go ahead and use it. Just quite bizarre. So let's move on, Hannah. That's enough about Swift, and that's enough about high-speed railway. Let's move on to Singapore. This is number six on our list, and it's four. Four is our statistic. Why is that?
Yeah, so this is the fourth tower that's going to be built for Marina Bay Sands. So Marina Bay Sands, I'm sure most listeners know, it's that very, very iconic hotel with the three towers and the kind of surfboard on top. So I was thinking, how are they going to build a fourth? Are they going to connect it or what? No, of course, it's going to be on a separate plot of land nearby. Set to be built by July 2029. Whole value is huge, $3.3 billion USD. I mean, it is in Singapore. That's not surprising. But this expansion was actually meant to be done by 2025. And then that was pushed to 2026 because of the pandemic. And now by 2029. So it's going to have the hotel. It's going to have a 15,000 seat arena. So clearly looking at that entertainment angle that we have talked about so many times. It's going to have a sky roof, MICE facilities. But not much more else is known about it, actually. So it's going to be big. It's going to be grand because it's Marina Bay Sands. Watch this space.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is part, I think we've discussed this beforehand, and this is part of the renewal of the licenses for the two integrated resorts, Marina Bay Sands and Resorts World on Sentosa, which both have casinos as part of their offering. And as part of the renewal of their licenses, I think their 10-year licenses, they were required to invest a lot more in non-gaming infrastructure and facilities, very similar to what's happening in Macau. Actually, there's a parallel line between the way that those resorts are developing in Macau. There are more of them in Macau and in Singapore. And this is the latest, and it's going to be a very, very visual, isn't it, realization of that investment. It's interesting that you mentioned that the fourth tower is going to be on a separate plot of land. I didn't realize that either. I was working out how that would happen. I remember being in Singapore, I think it was back in about 2007, 2008. I was there for New Year and they had the fireworks show, and the three towers were still being built. They hadn't connected it across the top, but they were glassing the outside. And I remember the fireworks were kind of reflected in the towers. And I wondered what it would look like. And then you think, well, projecting that forward into 2029, it's going to be an even bigger project. It's one of the region's most iconic developments, I would say, over the past 20 years. What do you reckon?
Yeah, for sure. So for those people, I've just been looking up whilst you've been talking, it is going to be on a plot bordered by Bayfront Avenue, Shears Avenue, and Shears Link. So there we go. You can all get your Google Maps out and figure out exactly where that is on the map for Singapore.
Right. So that takes us from the land, or the edge of the land, to the sea, Hannah. And this is about cruise travel, which is rebounding pretty fast across Southeast Asia. News stories all the time about cruise ships and cruise operators reintroducing new port stops, adding new themed cruises, that kind of thing. And this story takes us to our home country, Malaysia, where the number of cruise ships has actually surpassed 1,000. What's the exact figure?
Yeah, so 1,055, and that is the number of cruise ships who visited Malaysia in 2023. The impressive thing about that is it's actually up 85% versus pre-pandemic levels. So they have really kind of gone after cruise travel. They've seen about 1.5 million cruise passengers last year, so that's up about 62%. And they have home ports now in Port Klang. So Port Klang is the nearest port to Kuala Lumpur. It's still quite a way off if you were driving, but it's a home port there, which is a major win for them. Of course, whether it is a, you know, I've got pretty strong feelings about cruising, whether it is a win for the overall tourism industry and sustainability and the local communities is another thing. But certainly Malaysia look like they're trying to build the cruise industry into their Visit Malaysia 2026 strategy. And you're right, Gary, every country is talking again about cruises and developing ports and attracting them or publicizing how many cruise passengers visited this city or that city. Oh yeah, it is there, but I've got very conflicted views about whether it should be there, let's say.
Totally agree. Wonder whether somebody will propose a cruise visa, an ASEAN cruise visa. I wonder if that would ever happen. Let's see. So let's move on to our final story of this episode, Hannah. This takes us to Laos and to China, really. Last week, I think it was the 13th of April, marked 1 year, 12 months, since cross-border trips were permitted on the China-Laos Railway. Now, you may remember we've been talking about the China-Laos Railway for a long, long time. We spoke to Jason Rowland way, way back. Was it end of 2021, I think, the actual line was actually finished. But that was obviously during the pandemic. And so when it actually opened, trips were only permitted within Laos. But Jason told us he's been riding it many, many times. And it's great. Everybody you talk to who's ridden the railway says it's opening up access. We spoke to Inti, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago about adventure travel in Laos and how it's opening up access to different destinations, because one of the problems in Laos was always getting around the country. So this railway has really, really opened up travel around Laos and also to and from Laos and China. So across those 12 months, Hannah, there are 110,962 cross-border passenger trips across that first year, pretty much equally distributed in terms of inbound and outbound. I don't know whether that's a good figure or not, but it seems pretty high. And I guess it's only going to grow because, as we know, last year's recovery for the Chinese outbound market was relatively slow. It's starting to quicken the pace in the first quarter of this year and probably will accelerate across the rest of the year. So you'd imagine that figure will be a lot higher for the second year. But it's, again, we talked about Marina Bay Sands being one of the iconic infrastructure projects of the last 20 years. I'd say the China-Laos Railway will certainly be one of these that we'll be talking about over the next few years, probably Whoosh in Indonesia as well. These are projects that are really, really driving different types of tourism, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is the envy. I think, you know, we were just talking about high-speed rail for Vietnam, for Thailand. You know, I think they kind of envy Laos for having that connectivity right now. They all want it. They all want to try and connect to it somehow as well to really be able to tap onto that. I mean, it's interesting in terms of, you know, the 110,000, 111,000, if we round up, they don't break it down into nationality. So we don't know how many of those are Lao nationals, how many of those are Chinese nationals. But if you're looking at the overall number of Chinese visitors into Laos last year, was about 641,000. So let's say it's half. Let's say that, you know, there's what, about 55,000 Chinese perhaps who use this cross-border train. Okay, it's you know, getting on for almost 10%. Some wild maths there for a Friday morning. But, you know, it is contributing definitely to a different way to come into Laos from China. It was a lot of excitement around that too. And as you said, Gary, it's just that different way for people to get around Laos itself and make lots of areas much more accessible in a shorter period of time than they previously were.
Yeah, totally agree. It's good to finish on an upbeat story.
For sure. So with that brings the show to a close for the week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on anything we discussed or anything we missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yep. And as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and you can find us on any international podcast platform.
So that's a wrap for today. We'll be back next week to discuss more travel and tourism in Southeast Asia. See you then.